Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrillo.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey, everybody. I hope that you had a good week. We get right to it. Sebastian, what's your hottest take on Thanksgiving food?
Hottest take on Thanksgiving food? Thank you for asking this question. I think this is not as hot as it used to be back in 2010. But, you know, turkey's all right. You know, turkey is a vessel for gravy, in my opinion. and I think there are more exciting meats to cook, like pork, or I'm not a fan of ham, so I want to see pancake. Even chicken, I think. So that's my hot take of Thanksgiving.
Okay. So no turkey at your table next year.
Yeah, like, I mean, I eat it, I enjoy it, but it's truly a vessel for gravy. Like it's essentially bread. Alex, what's your take?
So I grew up eating my dad's sweet potato pie that he had like a pecan crust on that I thought was fantastic. And then the first time I ever had it with marshmallows on it, it's like, what are we doing here? Then I realized that's like an American tradition. And I don't know, America needs to get better or something.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, save it for Halloween. Mary, do you have any hot Thanksgiving takes?
Oh, man. I love Thanksgiving.
Heck yeah.
But my absolutely favorite thing to eat on Thanksgiving is Julia Child's fluffy pumpkin pie.
Fancy.
Which, if you have not had pumpkin pie with a very fine hint of bourbon.
Oh.
You should have.
I want to now. I'm hungry. Yes.
I'm writing it down. It'll go in our show notes even.
Yeah.
That's got to be tried.
That is really good. Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Zach, do you have anything?
Back to turkey. I'm a turkey fan, but it changed when we ordered a smoked turkey.
Oh, yeah, so that's true.
You don't have to cook it. You order it in advance. I like to plug Greenberg smoked turkeys from Texas. If you get a chance, ship anywhere in the country, I think. It tastes delicious and no prep work. So big fan. Yeah, I love Thanksgiving. It's my favorite holiday, too.
Well, there's Sebastian. You got to do smoked turkey next year.
Well, I have heard about this smoked turkey. I still haven't tried it, unfortunately, but I've heard, like, really good reviews from a lot of good people I trust in terms of food. So I need to try
frying a turkey is the way to go too. It's just a little dangerous, but it's worth it.
Yeah, I haven't never tried that, but it seems awfully dangerous.
All right. So as you've heard today, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. We have two guests today. Our first guest is Mary Eshelbach Hansen, and our second is Zach Bethune. In this episode, we're going to elevate and try to discuss four different job market candidates' pitches. Sebastian came up with this awesome name for the episode, Pitch Perfect.
Heck yeah.
We hope that, it's a fantastic name. Might or might not be stolen from some existing Disney Channel movies out there. I'm not sure. But if not, it should be the Disney Channel movie. So we're going to have four pitches today that we're going to talk about. The first one is going to be Laura Montanovo, a PhD student from Indiana University. The second one is going to be Alistair McCulley, a postdoc from St. Anne's College, University of Oxford. And the third one is going to be Jim Flynn, a PhD student from UC Boulder. And sorry, he put his name down as James Flynn, but my grandpa's name is Jim Flynn. So I just sort of rolled right into there. And then the fourth candidate is going to be Ashley Bradford, also from Indiana University. So they bravely sent us 1-minute pitches. We had requested 2-minute pitches, and apologies to the job market candidates that are software that we used gave a hard cap at 1 minute. And what we're hoping for today with the panel is if we could learn something about what makes a good job market pitch, what's successful about it, and hopefully also promote these candidates as well.
Great. Thank you, Alex. So let's start with talking a little bit with our guests. So Mary, how are you? And would you please share a fun fact about yourself?
Sure. I'm great. A fun fact story. How about a how I met my spouse story?
Okay.
That sounds great.
I met my spouse, Brad, at what amounts to economic history summer camp.
Oh.
It was a summer-long seminar in Munich. It was sponsored by the National Endowment for the Humanities, and it was about the Industrial Revolution on the continent. So my husband is obviously an economic historian, too. Best ever meeting.
Oh, that's amazing. So that's when you both met and then the relationship started soon after, or?
During the summer camp. You know, some good papers came out of that.
Wow, okay.
But I'm willing to bet actually that our marriage was its most impactful product.
Yeah, the best collaboration. That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. Zach, what's your fun fact?
My fun fact, so I grew up in Texas. I did high school here, and I played high school football So I like to say my life was like growing up in the TV show Friday Night Lights. I think, you know, hopefully people know what that is. Although I was not the star quarterback, so I was a much less revered position. But yeah, that's basically my upbringing, and then from there to the E contract.
You could have gotten in the NFL, right?
Yeah. If only a 5'8" slow person could make it in the NFL.
You're leaving us hanging. What position?
Offense, defense.
I played defensive linebacker.
Pretty important position.
Well, yeah. My job was see ball, go hit person with ball. So it's not not a very complex dynamic problem like we like to study in economics, but not particularly important.
I wonder if you took the intersection of people that were linebackers in high school that became economists. It might be one.
I know.
It might be you.
It might be one. I think I probably hit my head too many times. I may have lost a couple of good publications in there at a young age. I don't know.
It's all about trade-offs.
Did you own also a pickup truck? Did you had an accent, you know?
I owned a pickup truck. I used to listen to country music, which no more. Nothing wrong with country.
Why are you ashamed of your Texas Ruth?
I'm not ashamed at all. But
I was very much like
the stereotype quo letter jacket, like awesome. Varsity letter jacket.
So before we dive into today's topic, we like to spend some minutes seeing if you guys want to promote something, whether that's paper, research, an opportunity. We'll start with Marion and Zach.
I will take a minute to plug my book, which is co-authored with said spouse.
It's called
Bankrupt in America. I'm not going to really try and summarize it, but maybe I'll leave you with a teaser. If you currently think that the bankruptcy rate is a good measure of bad economic times, our book will explain why you should think again.
Now I want to know the answer, but I should probably read the book for it. Plus you get the royalties. We'll put this in the show notes. And I love the current cover art. I don't know if it's always been the same cover art. It's kind of like a little game, right? Is that right?
Is that my idea? No, was totally the publisher.
Is that not hinting at something then of the theme, or is it?
It's hinting at the theme. Yes.
Oh, interesting. Yes. Zach, what about you?
I guess I will plug some recent papers or an agenda we've been working on. So a lot of my research is in monetary economics and models where we work really hard to think about kind of micro-founded, what we say, like really modeling why people hold money and trade and how that matters in the macro economy and stuff. So we've been thinking about inflation for a long time, especially inflation that's induced by these like big episodes of money creation. And it just so happened we had a big episode of money creation in COVID. So it's a very like fun time to be working on these papers. So I, if you're interested in that stuff, you know, you could go find a recent paper I'm working on. We're working on a model with household heterogeneity, so households differ by their employment status, labor risk, wealth, all in a model of micro-founded money holdings. We study dynamics. We're kind of developing a framework. So if you're kind of interested in that heterogeneous agent macro in a model that doesn't have sticky prices but relies more on like these micro-foundations, then that's kind of the stuff we like to work on. So.
So before we listen to our pitches, which is what we'll do in a second, we want to talk about pitches in general. And we usually attach pitches to something about the job market process specifically, but in reality, it's just a way of quickly and hopefully cleanly communicating ideas of any research paper. So if you're not a job market paper, if you're not a job market candidate, listen to this podcast. I think this podcast could also be useful in just thinking about how to pitch a particular idea of a paper. But we are obviously using the setup of the job market candidates to get at that. So maybe let's talk about first about what do you think a good pitch should have? Like, what are the elements of a complete pitch in everyone's opinions? Zach, let's start with you, and then we'll do Mary.
Yeah. So first, let me just, the pitch, the idea of like 1 minute, 2 minute spiel on the stuff you're working on, it's very important for the job market, but I use it all the time. I mean, at conferences, you're talking to people, it's so common to be like, oh, what are you working on recently? And if you have that short pitch ready to go, it's a really impactful, I think, you know, quick advertisement and to get people hooked. So I'll say kind of two quick things I think on what make a great pitch. First, it has to be short. I mean, they used to call these things elevator pitches, right? Because it, you know, you have to get across what you're doing and get someone interested in the time it takes to, you know, get to a different floor on an elevator.
It could be the TikTok pitch now.
Yeah, yeah, right. And you could have a dance too, I guess. Maybe that's for the younger. Maybe not. Okay. So 1 to 2 minutes, I would say, I think is great. I mean, it doesn't have to be exactly that, but you want it to be quick. You can't take 5 minutes because, you know, people will lose interest at some point. And I'd say from my perspective, there's probably four key areas you should try to hit in that 1 to 2 minutes. I'd say you have to say what the research question is. You have to motivate why it's important. Why should we care about kind of what you're working on? It's important to find an answer to that question. Maybe give a hint at the methodology, and then don't forget to give us the punchline, right? You can't just say, I'm working on inflation, and then say, okay, see you later. You know, like, wait, like, what do you find? Right. Is it important? You know, yeah, exactly. Like, do something like that. I think if you have those categories, you don't have to answer everything. I think PhD students sometimes tend to err on the side of saying too much, trying to be too rigorous in these pitches. It's okay. You know, you'll have a chance to explain more, but but if you do these four things, I think that's what makes it great.
Practice makes perfect. And let me ask you a quick follow-up on that. Order of these elements, do they matter, or as long as the elements are there?
I think it varies. Depends on the research that you're doing. You know, I'm a very logical thinker, so I like to think about, you know, what your research question is. It, you know, the order that I did, then tell me the punchline at the end. But, you know, I think it's equally effective if you say, my paper finds this very surprising fact, and then kind of go backwards and say, here's how I do it. So I don't think there's the right way to do it.
Mary, what's your take? What elements makes a good pitch?
Right. So I think Zach and I generally agree. Although I think for most people, it makes more sense to tell us what you found. My paper shows that X influences Y by Z percent, at least in micro. That is not absolutely always the case. So there are, I agree with Zach entirely, there are no absolute rules, right? The way you tell your story is going to depend upon what your story is. The most important thing, though, is that we do not write mystery novels. So I need to know what you found, right? What you did may be interesting, and certainly we'll have to have a conversation about it, but I need to know what you found. The other thing that I just want to say that I think is super important are the words that you use to describe what your work is doing. So economists measure things. They don't explore things. Study, maybe. I'm just not a fan of study either, even though I know we write it a lot in abstracts now, but economists measure things.
I feel like you'll like Sarah Hammerschma has this whole thing on statistical grammar that we've talked about before, where I feel like that's right up that alley of like being precise.
Yeah.
And just as a little bit of I maybe should have led with this earlier on, the kernel of an idea of this episode came from long ago when I was on the job market at Economic History Association, and Mary kept coming up to me at a poster and being like, what's your pitch? What's your pitch? Like over and over again throughout the poster session, or maybe I forget how many hours the session was, and I was realizing like, you know, so fix this element. And what I started to realize was like, I don't really know how to sell it really fast without someone who's willing to stand there and look at a complicated graph. And maybe I didn't even know how to sell it that way. So I think that these points are all really important that you all are bringing up. And what I've started to even more realize is the pitch and the intro and the little conversation you're having with people to describe the paper starts way before, you know, 10 minutes before you're going to have that conversation. It starts when you're writing the introduction. So after you've done your analysis and you have results, how are you packaging the paper, right? Like, where do you think the contributions are? And then how can you filter that down to its essence, so to speak, like writing a little abstract? So anyways, that's what Mary helped me at least start to do.
That's so good. You can't start with the pitch, right? It's really the pitch is the very quick summary of all the work you're doing in an approachable way.
And the order in which you think about these things is important, right? So what I see, I advise a lot of PhD students. So what I see is that students forget to go back and rewrite the abstract.
Yeah.
After, you know, they wrote a proposal. And then I'm getting the final version and the abstract is the same as the proposal version. And I'm like, no. But right, the other important thing before we sort of get into individual pitches is a pitch needs should be conversational. Right? It should be natural speaking. We don't listen the way we read, right? We take in information differently through our ears than we do through our eyes. So a list, for example, probably a bad idea. Decimal points, also a bad idea, right?
No figures and tables.
Pass out transparencies.
It's got to be simple, right?
I'd add in also that I think it has to be approachable, but that may depend on your audience a bit, right? If you know you're talking to someone in the field, you could rely a little more on jargon, but you want to have ready. I mean, you know, this happens a lot in macro because macro is a huge umbrella, right? You have people working on labor and people working on inflation, and you want to kind of, you know, get to the point where you're not underestimating your audience, but also not assuming that they're an expert in every little, you know, jargon. So what I like to use a lot is you know, if you have a technical phrase like, you know, transmission mechanism or something like that. I mean, that's sort of jargony. Just say like what I, you know, like as an example, I mean this, right? When the Fed does something, people respond in some way. I mean, that's a very easy way to say in you know, plain English what a transmission mechanism is. And then it doesn't like, isolate the expert you might be talking to also.
I like that quite a bit. My wife has also recommended when I was writing exams that I run them through a grade level checker to make sure that I wasn't like accidentally making it more complicated than it needed to be. And I do that now with sometimes like abstracts and things too, where like, am I using like needlessly complicated words, like just to sound fancy?
It tells you that it's not like what reading level.
Yeah.
Is,
there's this one I like, I think it was some development economist posted on Twitter once, but it's like the Hemingway app, and it checks for like passive voice, like how long and complicated is the sentence and this, and I don't know, maybe it's like harvesting all my personal information, but I run stuff through there frequently. So I really, what I've said with the introduction, I think has helped me quite a bit. So I realized this both with writing my tenure packet, but also like I've been recently putting a lot of focus on like trying to get a couple papers to intros really good. And then I realized sort of accidentally, afterwards, when I describe myself now, or when I describe the paper I've been working on, I think I just do a better job. And I think it's clearer to people that are maybe like, sort of as Zach was saying, like in a different field, like what's the contribution? What do I do? And I'm to the point really quickly. And I didn't enjoy the process of writing the tenure packet. And I didn't really enjoy the process of writing an intro 40 times, but
you got tenure.
But yeah, sure. Right. Yeah. Select on the dependent variable or select on the outcome. Right. But like so I think that like starting at the big sort of convoluted thing, thinking about it and then distilling it would be sort of my advice. I don't know if it matters how much the order, like you could lead with the cliffhanger, like people have always wondered this. I answer that in this way. And then it sort of leads with importance versus here. But, you know, starting with a finding too, like everybody, I think, would be interested in the minimum wage. You might not need to start off that way, or inflation right now is a hot topic. So it kind of depends on the context.
That makes sense. I found recently that the pitches that I've been hearing, contain the research question, contain the how, contain the finding, but they don't really contain the why is it important. And so I've been nudging people to think about how does your pitch answer the question of why does it matter type of thing. And I usually, I mean, this is, I don't think this is universal, but I like to, at least when I think about my papers or my pitches, start off on that question of like straight up tell you like why it's important, and then I'll tell you everything else. And but that's just because of like, I'm so anxious to hear like, why do I care about this like particular fact that I'm like, you know, that, okay, now that I know that, then I'm going to care about what the punchline is. But sometimes you're right. Like if people know the context, the punchline is like, so like, wow. So, but anyways, that's like,
yeah, we don't want to take it for granted. Right. But there was another student that isn't someone that sent us a pitch that I saw at a summer conference, and they were talking to another faculty member. I had read their job market paper, and then they were explaining it to this other faculty member, and the person just like stopped them. It was like, well, I have no idea what you're talking about. You just cited like four authors, like an authority argument. like, I don't know this literature, you know, and like for to this student though, they've been working in this topic for years.
Right.
So, but they just jumped like into the deep end. So,
yeah, I always have to tell grad. So I'll ask grad students all the time. I mean, third year, fourth year, like, okay, you know, what are you working on? Tell me, tell me the project. And it's very, especially in macro, it's very common. We get very into models and that's a big part of our methodology. So they start with, you know, I'm working on a model that has X, Y, and Z. I'm like,
what? Yeah, exactly.
To get anyone to care about whatever model you're going to write, you got to like tell them why you're writing it. That's the thing you want to answer. Why is that the right tool? Right. So Alex, I think you're, and Sebastian, I think you're exactly right. I mean, get us kind of into, you know, you have to hook someone. It's like you pick up a novel and you want to, you know, the novel doesn't start with, you know, some detail about one of the characters. It you know, brings you in that makes you want to open it up and read it. I think pitches, you know, have to do that.
I think the other thing too is like tension. Sometimes I mean, I don't think every pitch you have tension, but for example, sometimes I once heard a pitch of a student being like, you know, in this paper, I investigate the effects of Medicaid insurance expansions on health. And part of me is like, okay, that's been done before. Like what's your twist or whatever. And they did, I can't remember what it was, but they did have a, like a tension point of like, well, it's been studied this, but we don't know about this other margin, whatever. And so I'm like, oh, try to add that to your pitch. And I think that the example that I give is, so my job market paper, which I can talk about because I'm 6 years out, I'd already published it. Woo! It was about people losing health insurance on health outcomes. And so I could have like, I initially actually pitched that paper. It's like, oh, I'm just running a, you know, a paper, it's a paper on like Medicaid on health. And everybody would be like, well, we already have that, right? And so what I, then it evolved to, well, it's a paper about losing health insurance and health, but it still needed flavor. So then I eventually started with, most of what we know from the literature on health insurance and health comes from this experience in which people are gaining insurance rather than people are losing insurance. And there might be asymmetric effects of these things. In my paper, just by like a few lines, I'm like, wow, that makes a huge difference. Like how interesting the same reg YX is in terms of like the framing of the stuff. So that's when I was like, okay, pitches matter for sure.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. So I think like, you know, this is the benefit of practicing your pitch a lot. If you're always getting the question, wait, we've the answer to this, then I think it's really smart to add in a little bit of acknowledgement that you're not the first, but you're doing it in a unique, different way. However, if you never get that question, then maybe it's not needed, right? I mean, a lot of it, if you're never thinking about it, maybe you don't want to go on about, you know, what other people have done. I mean, you know, I think especially grad students tend to be, you know, a little heavy on making sure they establish everyone that's done everything in the history of, you know, their field before they get to their contribution.
Totally.
So I think you want to, my perspective, I think you want to be flexible.
Okay, let's move into hearing some pitches. So the first pitch we're going to hear is from Laura Montenovo from Indiana University.
Hi, I'm Laura Montenovo, a PhD candidate at the O'Neill School of Public Affairs at Indiana University. In my research, I focus on the effects of large labor reforms on the outcomes of both firms and workers. In particular, I focus on a policy that has decreased employment protection regulation among firms above a certain size. And I study how the size distribution, dynamism, and productivity of firms were affected by such change. I also turn to workers and investigate how their termination, hiring rates, and job match quality were impacted by the reform. In a separate but related line of research, I study how a reform that has made unemployment insurance benefits homogeneous geographically has impacted the job outcomes and opportunities among workers in weaker labor markets.
Let me start. I think this pitch has talked a little bit about the what it's doing. I think hinted at the research question. But for example, this is, I think, an example to me, like I haven't been told, I think, why this is important, even though maybe I can insinuate why is it important. But what do you guys think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what I really liked about what Laura did was she spoke slowly.
That's true. Clearly. That's true.
Right? I really thought that was important. I understood everything she said. I was able to follow her, but I agree with Sebastian. I know what she did. I don't know what she found,
right,
or why I should care. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know why I care.
Right.
Because I do some labor stuff, right? So labor protections, unemployment, related to unemployment, right? I know these things.
I think she did a good job at the very beginning, kind of outlining what type of economist she is. She kind of like laid out an agenda. She has what seems like she's going to tell us about, look, I have this exciting agenda on labor reforms and studying the outcomes of firms or workers. I think great. Whether that's in the job market or just introducing yourself to someone that you haven't met before, this is the type of stuff I work on. I like that. I think it's a nice intro.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where I thought she could use a little work is, yeah, what you've already mentioned, she didn't give us the punchline. What do you find? Like, what's our one takeaway? I think I want to go home and saying, oh, Laura's doing this really exciting work on labor reforms, and she's finding this interesting effect. I don't have the effect, right? I would also caution her a bit on using some jargon. I think she threw in like dynamism, firm size distribution, productivity. Mm-hmm. I mean, to some extent, we can understand that, but you haven't told us, you know, why are those the outcomes of interest, right? Why, what is dynamism? Why do we think that's important? There's a big literature on that, of course, but add that in there. You know, it doesn't take long to just say, you know, entry and exit of firms instead of dynamism.
I agree with you, Zach. I think that I might encourage her to pick what she thinks is the single most important result in her paper. And in that 30 seconds or a minute that you've got somebody's attention, just give me the most important takeaway. Right. Mm-hmm. There may be six different, you know, sets of regressions, but
yeah, I agree. Find the one, maybe two, but probably one big takeaway to have.
Another thing that I resonate with what you said too, Zach, is I think when people throw like a lot of words one after the other, my brain is like slowing down. So like it takes me a little bit to understand. It's not like I don't have training in this. I think it's still, and I can understand it. I think I have to like full attention. And so I imagine if I'm like in a crowded room with a bunch of things, this is the reason why you want to quote unquote use less technical terms and more like your dialogue. Because even a person with a lot of experience may not be able to understand you.
Yeah. And you know, I like this pitch a lot, and I struggle here to provide comments because like I know bits about this paper already. And like I know we're talking about pitch, but also I think like title is important too. So like initially I know, and I think this happens with a lot of us, like we have a complicated title or a different title or a different pitch, and then we iterate, like Sebastian talked about earlier. So I know here, like something Laura's been working on has been iterating towards a more general pitch, where it started off sort of initially. I remember the title being something really complicated and long about this Italian labor market reform. But I'm like, I don't even know what the labor market reform is, or why does it matter that it's Italy, or why does it, you know, in general. And instead, now the paper kind of highlights and focuses on the beginning at being about like, well, what happens if you make it easier for firms to do what they want to do in sort of an unrestricted sense? And it was all about like protections, making it easier to fire people. So it's something you might think is like, oh, maybe that's a bad thing, but it has this trade-off where it sort of makes
that's the tension right there
a little more able to do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. So anyways, like I was happy to hear this pitch, but then I didn't want to provide a lot of feedback because it's hard for me to pull out this knowledge that I have on the paper.
Awesome. Let's move into our second pitch, James Flynn.
Tragically, lower-income women in the United States are much more likely than higher-income women to experience an infant death. Several studies have also shown that lower-income women are much more likely to be unable to access their preferred method of contraception, with cost being the most frequently cited barrier. This raises the question, then, of whether expanding access to long-acting reversible contraceptives, or LARCs, has the ability to lower the infant mortality rate by giving lower-income women autonomy over if and when to have children. Studying the effect of contraceptive access on infant health outcomes is complicated by the fact that states which provide more liberalized access to contraception are also different than other states on many other dimensions. To get around this endogeneity, I used the rollout of three privately funded family planning programs which provided free LARCs to lower-income women in Colorado, Iowa, and St. Louis as a source of plausibly exogenous variation in LARC access. Using both a staggered treatment event study and synthetic control design, I find that these programs reduced the infant mortality rate by 1.1 deaths per 1,000 live births, or roughly 18%. I find significant reductions in deaths due to maternal pregnancy complications, birth defects, sudden infant death syndrome, and homicide, all of which are highly correlated with socioeconomic status. Furthermore, since the programs in Colorado and Iowa were not uniformly administered across the states, I show that the reductions in adverse infant health outcomes are highly concentrated within the counties, which also have Title X family planning clinics where the programs were implemented. I also find a dose response where counties with more of these clinics appear to have a larger reduction in infant deaths. These findings suggest that there is considerable scope to narrow the infant mortality gap which exists between the U.S. and other leading world economies by expanding contraceptive access to lower-income women nationwide. It also suggests that the states which have recently introduced laws which would ban contraception outright would potentially face serious unintended consequences if they were to do so.
All right, so that was James Flynn. I'm now starting to notice that my attention has really decreased in this past few years in the pandemic. But I'll let somebody else start with their takes on this pitch. What do you guys like about this pitch?
Okay, so I like that, you know, I laid out these four things I think are great to have in a pitch. I mean, he nailed all four, right? He had the motivation, he had the question, he even put in some methodology, and he told us what he found. So I think that was all really great.
Yeah, I agree. What I really appreciated about his approach is that he definitely wanted to start out with a real world fact. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing policy oriented work, I think that that is super important. Glad that he did that. I suspect that was his original motivation started this. And then maybe some things have happened in the last year.
Right.
And that has led him to this new conclusion, which he put at the end.
Mm.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking maybe he should take that conclusion about states that are thinking or have banned contraceptives, mm-hmm. or thinking about doing that, and serve that up to us.
So, like, if you were a reporter writing this, you wouldn't bury the lead at the end, which is like, this is the new reason you should care about this. You'd put that at the beginning and be like, what do we know about this?
I mean, I wouldn't so much as call it a rule, but it is often the case that when we write a first draft of something, when we get to the end, that thing at the end often belongs at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So every time that I write something for myself, I look at it and say, well, if this is where I wound up, maybe I shouldn't tell people where I'm going at the mm-hmm. beginning, because again, we're not writing mystery novels.
One thing that I was wondering about this pitch on the why it matters is, I think one question that leaves me that I have after this pitch is like, okay, so a program that was meant to increase birth control for women in some way did increase it, and therefore has the, you know, and like consequences. But part of me wants to say, like, isn't that something that we already know? That, like, if we create a program to give birth control to low-income women, then that's going to do it. But so that's the part where I feel like I needed a little bit of tension. But Alex, what do you think?
I mean, economists will ask you that. So, like, be prepared for that. Be prepared for, like, why is this economics? People ask you that, or like, why is it identified? But, like, I think it's important to know the size of the estimate, right? Like, if we provide
that's fair.
Its take up,
that's
like,
fair.
What's the effect? So,
yep. Like a measurement question, right? So,
but I'm like applied that, micro. So,
but to me, that requires a motivation that is focused on like, we need to understand a little bit how big of this an effect is relative to maybe other programs, as opposed to, I think I think there is already, I don't know, my sense is that people buy the idea that, like, we need to provide, you know, birth control to women. But anyways,
so one of the things that related to this that it could be useful for him to think about, and maybe taking his three sentences about identification strategies and summarizing them, saying, I use my main identification strategy is X, I use a whole bunch of other confirmatory tests to make some room for saying, so I'm pretty sure that the long-acting contraceptives that he's studying are relatively new and they haven't been studied as well as the pill,
mm-hmm.
for example. So we know this for the pill, but the pill isn't something you're stuck with for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't involve, you know, a procedure.
Yeah.
And so maybe we should make sure that this also holds for things like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not absolutely certain that is the contribution here, but that would be the kind of thing I would like him to talk about.
I guess it wasn't, I mean, this is way outside my field, obviously, but.
Which is good to have your perspective but, from like, you know, from that.
But it wasn't, you kind of started with saying, yeah, isn't a little bit obvious, but I thought his main outcome of interest was infant deaths per birth. So the denominator goes down if you add contraceptives, but it's not clear how, if the numerator goes down more or less. So I think actually like the sign of the effect doesn't matter, you know, is not obvious to me. So it's interesting the direction he found, I think. What I would have liked more, and this is my macroeconomist brain, was
is a model.
Is yes, a full model of no. It, but is a little, just tell us a little bit about what is the link between contraceptive and infant death? Like it, like kind of a priori, what's the mechanism? Oh, I mean, how does it actually work? I mean, and it could be
pure selection, right? Like you were kind of bringing up.
Right. That's a good point.
Exactly. Yeah. Just kind of lead us into that. Cause right now it's like, okay, you kind of motivate with these two facts, like infant deaths, you know, are disproportionately happening of people with a certain socioeconomic status. Survey evidence says that, you know, that it's cost prohibitive. Okay, give us a link. If you were to randomly give out these contraceptives, how do you think this thing is actually working? Would be helpful.
To get back to some things about not using jargon, I would add to the not using jargon, not using acronyms. I think he gave his long acting contraceptives a name and give it. So I would not do that. I also
want to make a hat or something that says that. I say that to every PhD acronyms. Student. There's acronyms in the abstract. Something bad has happened.
Interesting. Yes,
that's bad. I would also say this is not the place to define Title X. I happen to know what Title X is.
Interesting.
The rest of the world does not need to worry about Title X.
I totally agree. That was one of the things I wrote down. And then like, I actually liked this. I thought there were lots of good things in there. I think it should probably be 25% slower, which means you're going to have to cut stuff. I know the format's kind of weird. We gave people a minute. It's not exactly how your pitch would be in a real elevator or escalator or whatever, but like there was a lot in there. And so I had to be like on the entire time. And there weren't many opportunities for a distracted me to catch back up.
Yeah.
And so that's, I like those kind of on-ramps back to the thought process.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. In fact, I wrote down a few things that I think you could cut. Like, I don't think he needs the straw man. Like, you may not want to look at this just across states because there's a lot of differences across. I mean, that I think your audience will know that. I don't think you need that in there. Just skip it. Go on to like, here's like Mary said, here's kind of what I use to identify it. I think everyone will be on the same page there.
Third one is going to be Alistair McCauley, a postdoc from St. Anne's College, University of Oxford.
My name's Alistair McCauley. I'm a macroeconomist, and I'm currently a postdoc at the University of Oxford. My job market paper asks the question, does heterogeneity in expectations of macro variables affect the way shocks transmit through the economy to aggregate outcomes? Now that's important because it's been extremely well documented that expectations of macro variables do tend to be very heterogeneous. There's a lot of disagreement among households and firms and investors about the future of all macroeconomic variables. But it's a common practice among policymakers and indeed lots of academics when working with expectations data to treat that heterogeneity as sort of second order. And they'll focus really on the median or some other measure of the average expectation of interest. Now, the first contribution of my paper is to show that in a general macroeconomic framework, heterogeneity in expectations can itself drive a channel of aggregate shock transmission, which you miss if you just focus on average expectations, and indeed which has been assumed away in existing literature on expectations. So heterogeneous expectations can really matter for macroeconomic dynamics. Now that's very general. My second contribution is then to apply this idea and study how important this novel channel can be in the case of household beliefs about inflation. So using some unique questions in a Bank of England household survey and a model that matches that survey data, I find that just over a third of the transmission of inflationary shocks to aggregate consumption comes through heterogeneous expectations. But that transmission channel also varies over time, and in particular, it implies that large temporary spikes in inflation can get baked in or entrenched into certain household expectations, with persistent consequences for macro dynamics going forward.
All right.
Can I start with what I loved about this?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I do know macro. And I understood very clearly what Alistair was doing.
Okay. Excellent. Right?
Mm-hmm. And so that for people who do models, that's really amazing.
Mm.
Right? Mm. Like mm-hmm. to communicate to me what your point was.
Oh. So one thing I agree that I think it was clear in the beginning to me, I have to say two things that like, I think I was explained why is it important, but I think I missed it. And I don't know if that's like a feel thing or the thing we talked about, a jargon that always happens. So I'm curious to for Zach, if it felt like for you, it was like, this is obvious why it's an important period kind of thing.
Yeah. So I think he did a great job. So I'll say the glowing stuff in a minute. I getting back to your point, I think like, you know, this is something I think macroeconomists struggle with, talking about things like transmission mechanisms. Yeah. I mean, I think people all have different ideas of what that actually means. Why is understanding a transmission what is a transmission mechanism, first of all? Why is understanding if it's an important channel? It's really a channel, right? It's, you know, like a partial derivative. If I change some policy X, there's some derivative on aggregate outcomes. But that feeds through a bunch of household level decisions and stuff. And you want to characterize, well, there could be a lot of partials in that big model. Okay, which ones are important? All right, that may be too technical still. I don't know. But and I think the short is like you wanna explain what that is, probably, right? If it's just a macro audience, no need to. But maybe that's where it came across.
But for you, it was clear why that question was important then.
The question, yeah, I think absolutely. Okay. I think one thing let me give a bit of the positives first.
Yeah,
I think it was very clear for a lot of part. I think he showed a really good job of having a conversational style, right? Of saying like, you know, why is, I think he even said maybe at some point, like, you know, that's important because it's mm-hmm. telling us immediately, like, you should care about this. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you in plain English why. I thought that was fantastic. So I recommend, you know, go back, listen to that, you know, rewind the podcast, listen to that. I think it's a great way to have mm-hmm. a conversational style. There were a few areas that I think he kind of assumed that it was obvious where it wasn't. So one, he said, you know, going back to that's important. He said, it's important because when we measure expectations, people have different expectations of a common aggregate variable. What is inflation? We're going to disagree and say what our expectations of future inflation are. That's going to be different. And that's the key thing he's building into his model, right? I mean, I should go read the paper because it sounds very interesting, but that's kind of baking in, right? I mean, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of like facts we could document. You know, there's elephants in the world. Why don't mm-hmm. that's important because we measure a lot of elephants in the world, put them into a model. You know, that's condescending a bit, but you don't want to do that. You want to say, okay, this thing I'm going to add in is well documented. But here is the channel that I'm going to explore, and it's important to understand this channel. Mm. And I think that last part was missing from the spiel.
So I think actually all three we've listened to so far have had, in their own way, very good pacing. But for my personal tastes, with my like, I'm not as quick as some people when they're listening to
stuff.
I'm
very slow.
The pacing here was slow enough for me. And actually Laura's was too. Both of them were slow enough where I could follow. And like, so if I lost something, I was going to be able to pick it back up. I'm just to nitpick though on these terms, like and again, this is like any economist, questions arise that aren't going to be all immediately answered. But when he was talking about like all heterogeneous expectations, I was like, oh, like how are they heterogeneous? Is that important? Mm. Is it just like variance or like, you know, right. And like, you can't answer every question as you're going through, but I started to get like questions were bubbling up, but maybe that's the sign of a good pitch. Cause that could then lead to a conversation. But for me, I started to, the lack of my knowledge of the field started to mm-hmm. cause me to be right. not totally sure what he was referring to, even though mm-hmm. I knew the words.
I tend to like, if it's even translated to like, let's say, you know, that two people, one person thinks that inflation is going to be really high and the other person is inflation is going to be really low. How does that, but because that gives me a sense of like, oh, that's a heterogeneity.
But on what dimension is there heterogeneity, yeah, right? Yeah, like So.
But maybe this is like, as you said, Zach, like not a dumb market problem, but like a macro problem of how do we translate it to us people who don't do this.
I think the idea of the transmission, like what is a transmission mechanism here, is kind of why it's important to understand these things. Like that's very much like a macro thing that we probably all macroeconomists need to be better at communicating. Mm-hmm. But for him, I think he has a really, so I went to go look at his paper when you sent me the pitch, because I was very interested. And it's not just about like, so it's partly about differences in expectations. Like if you ask people, you know, if you survey people, what is inflation going to be next quarter? We're going to differ in our answers. But that could be related to two different things. We may be collecting different information about the states of the economy, what past inflation was, what prices I see in the supermarket, stuff like that. And we may also have different models of how we take that information and then form expectations. So there's those kind of differences that I think you can explain in plain English, right? That I see different information than you, and then we're going to do different things even if we get the same information. And right. I think that's in his paper. I think he wants to bring that back into the pitch a little bit to make it more grounded and actually like talking in conversational language about what he's doing.
And I think that there's some detail in there that he could leave out in order to make room for the conversation starters, the colloquial part, and the explainers. Because this isn't going to be the end, right? I think a lot of graduate students think they're going to, you know, sit down and somebody's going to say, so tell me about your job market paper. And then they're going to there's not going to be a conversation after that.
Right.
So it's very much a conversation starter.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so we'll get time for all your cool details and your supplementary results later in a conversational way to talk about the kind of thing that Alistair is talking about is, you know, to say it's to start by saying, you know, it's been extremely well documented, right? You could say we already know that. Fewer words. We already know that expectations are all over the place. But you know, in our modeling, we still use means and modes, medians, right? My job market paper shows what we miss when we simplify like that.
I think Zach might have said this earlier, but like, and then this, but this relates to the point you were bringing up, Mary. When you start with like, I'm this, my name is this, I do this, my job market paper broadly is this. It's like robust to being interrupted, because like, you're right, it is a conversation and it's like a signpost for what's going to happen later. It's not like an abstract, even though we keep referring to it that way, where it's just written there and like the kid can scream, then you can come back and read it again later. It's a conversation that might ebb away from where you were going. So you want to get the most important facts down first.
You could very well get interrupted, you know, Alistair, for instance, and say, what do you mean? We have different expectations. Like, can you give me an example?
Right.
And then you have to have this ability of giving a quick example, but then bringing it back to kind of your line of, you know, back to your spiel, back to your pitch.
I think that the new, the sequel to this episode is all of us reading a job market paper and creating a pitch for them. But that would be super fun. Because then
I think that sounds dangerous.
Then we kind of like test ourselves, right? It's like, okay, if you know so much about pitches, give us your pitch. Mary's like, no.
I think you guys don't have enough work to do. Yeah. And maybe I should send you some of my work.
No, guys. That's
fair. This is our outlet for not doing our actual work.
I have this bias that when I hear a British accent, I'm like, that person is smart. Like straight up.
I mean, honestly, it's unfair. Yeah. There should be another job market for British people.
Yeah.
Or like a voice modulator.
Yeah.
You know, just change it. Have everyone have like a, you know, Texan voice like I have. And it's perfect.
You know, that's an interesting thing, right? Could we do it? It would be like, you know, the CC Conrad, Claudio Golden paper, you know, behind the screen, auditions behind the screen.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, and I, you know, pitches behind the accent.
Okay, last one. Ashley Bradford from Indiana.
Hi, my name is Ashley Bradford. I am a health policy researcher who is primarily interested in public policies that either directly govern or indirectly impact risky behaviors and substance use and how that impact varies for different groups. So a lot of my research agenda so far is focused on the impact of cannabis and opioid policies on health-related outcomes such as self-reported drug use or high-risk prescribing. And a more recent part of my research agenda has explored the intersection between housing policies and risky behaviors. So my job market paper explores the impact of nuisance ordinances, which are a class of municipal law which generally make it easier for landlords to evict their tenants. And I find that these laws are leading to increases in several categories of drug-related mortality rates in the state of Ohio. And I find that these effects seem to be moving both through the eviction pathway and through 911 hesitancy. So this is a research agenda that I hope to continue moving forward.
Okay, great. Let me start on this one. So one thing that I liked, I think the other ones definitely, you know, were like recording a pitch and they felt very nice and clear. To me, this here is much more natural in terms of like what I would hear on a regular conversation. And I actually like that about it. Maybe some people would think about it, but I was like, I like that it feels like very normal in that way. I obviously thought it was clear and I think I understood what it was doing. It's interesting because now that I'm seeing this, like for me, I know why it's important and that's why I didn't care about her not having that, but maybe she did need to have the why it's important. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, so I liked once she got into the job market paper, I thought it flowed pretty well. As she said, I'm interested, you know, I'm studying nuisance ordinances. And then she told us, okay, what is that? Which I think was pretty
good. Yeah, I like that too.
And maybe you get the question of, you know, what do you mean by it makes it easier? And that's something easy she could answer and then come back to her spiel. So I thought that was actually really good. She gave us the takeaways. I would have liked a little bit more. You know, she said that it's, you know, seems related to the eviction pathway. What is that? I have no idea what that is. 9/11 hesitancy. I can imagine what that is, but can you tell us kind of like what? And then like, what are you basing those statements on, right? Like, I think it's, you know, I find it's related to the eviction pathway because I find this, right? And here's what that means. I think that'd be helpful. I think like I liked at the beginning, she said kind of who she is, but I thought she was actually a little too long. I thought her job market paper was going to be on cannabis and opioid policies. Because I don't know if she spent one or two sentences on that, but to me, it felt kind of long. I mean, I really am used to a very quick, I'm a health policy, you know, economist studying these types of policies.
As opposed to the broader,
And I think she took a few other extra sentences to say, you know, I study cannabis and opioid policies. So I was ready. I was jumping in. I was like, all right, this is the job market paper. Let's listen up. And then she switched right very quickly to the job market paper. I would cut that out, you know, or maybe just rephrase it in a way to kind of, you know, talk about it maybe at the end of another paper she had.
This is a good question because in economics departments, definitely we're expecting, tell me about your job market paper.
Right.
And the pitch is about the job market paper. My recollection was that my colleagues in public policy wanted to know about the research or the dissertation,
the broader umbrella, the job market
paper. And so I think this is an important thing for everybody in an economics department who's listening to this, right? If you're only preparing a job market pitch about your job market paper, you need to have a way to deliver it when the question isn't tell me about your job market paper, it's tell me about your research.
I like that. And I think part of it is, I know a lot about Ashley's profile. Ashley has like 10 publications, right? So it's one of those things with like, I think if I were on like the advanced market and someone was like, tell me about your job market paper, I'd still probably like politician style answer a different question. Be like, well, hey, I'm Alex. I study these things broadly. A lot of my work's in this area. My job market paper, though, it's on this one niche. Right. And so it kind of isn't totally answering the first question, but it sets up the theme of what I want to talk about. And I think with like Ashley, maybe, you know, I think that makes sense to do because of this long CV that she has sort of entering. Whereas if you just have a job market paper, I agree, right? You don't want to like start signposting a bunch of like thoughts that you have.
I think, right, the broader lesson seems also, this is like a function of like, know your audience maybe. Yeah. So like some people are going to want to know what your research is and that interest great. And some people are like, what's your job market paper on it? So you don't need the whole preamble kind of thing. Obviously we didn't give them so many prompts to our people, so they didn't know, but the broader lesson is kind of like know your audience kind of thing, or listen to the question maybe.
or even just like change up the wording a little bit, I think could help. Mm-hmm. If she said like, I'm a health policy economist, I study policies like, you know, or I study housing policies and cannabis opioid policies, you know, in my research, in my job market paper, then I do this. Right. So it's kind of like, oh, you study a bunch of interesting policies. You're going to tell me about a paper on housing policy. And then maybe if I'm interested, you know, you're going to, and you have time, tell me a paper on these other policies you study. I would also like to, if she could add in a few things about magnitude, she gave us the direction of the effect. And I think because she she didn't have like the big motivation of we want to understand, you know, I mean, I think obviously opioid drug-related deaths, you know, I think it's common to understand that that's a big problem nowadays. Evictions, I think I at least know less about the recent trends in that. Is that a, you know, to what extent is that a problem? And then she could add some magnitudes to say this policy actually has a big effect, you know, or compare it to, you know, the effects of other kinds of policies that the literature finds. Maybe not go down the road too much, but give us something of like, okay, you know, instead of just the mm-hmm. direction, what's the magnitude? Mm-hmm.
Alex, do you want to give us a quick summary of what we learned, some major takeaways?
Okay, so I'll try my best to give a quick summary of all the stuff we learned today. You know, I think what we learned, though, is a good pitch is something that people will pay attention to that conveys the information you want to have conveyed. And then you want to be thoughtful about, well, what is that information? You know, I think we talked about having good pacing when you're asking, well, what is the question? Why is it important? What are maybe the methods if you have some time in there? And I really like Mary's phrase, you know, the words you use are important, and we do not write mystery novels. So you want it to be as clear as day when you're done giving the pitch. And that practice makes perfect, and that this is a distillation of lots of effort trying to answer those questions and trying to make things clear, not something you come up with off the top of your head right before you give an interview.
I love it. And I think one thing I want to quickly add is that while your paper may be important, could have different answers. And just because you found one doesn't mean that that's the one you should go with. You should, you know, pitch it to different people and understand that that could be changing. Great. Thank you so much for those insights. Every week, we like to ask our guests for our recommendation of the week. This could be anything, a podcast, a command, an app, a song, a quote, a book, a kitchen recipe, anything that improves your life in a small way. What is your recommendation of the week? Start with Mary.
Oh, everybody should take a minute and go back and listen to a Johnny Cash song.
Hey, any specific Cash
song? I'm not sure it matters.
Okay.
Hurt.
Yeah. Hurt. Yeah. Amazing. Zach, what about you? What's your recommendation?
That is a great recommendation. I want to steal Mary's recommendation. Johnny Cash song. I was gonna. Okay, so I have two. One is very general. I found it very useful recently to unplug a bit from my phone. I got in COVID. I got so plugged in. I would like watch TV, falling asleep, you know, and I would be on a screen all the time. I got physical books again. You know, nice. This is the thing where like you, it's on paper and you open it. It's this crazy concept.
Wait, what? So, and the battery?
I know. It's crazy, yeah. Right? It's crazy. And the battery, yeah, it never goes out. It's a little hard in the dark, but I'll give you the book I'm reading right now is a book. This will be very like, you know, maybe too technical, but it's econ, sort of econ adjacent. It's a book about the creation of the Ethereum blockchain and cryptocurrency.
Oh.
I will say that it's nerd. Not like this super wonky. If you ever want to know why do people go crazy about this stuff, I'm not like a big crypto person. I do some monetary economics, which is, you know, obviously related. It's a fantastic book. It's something that I think anyone could pick up and be like, oh, I didn't know what that's what they meant when they said, you know, the blockchain or whatever.
Yeah.
It's called The Infinite Machine. Sebastian, Alex, you could probably link to it.
Yeah.
Camille, yeah, no, we'll put it in there.
Camilla Russo. It's very good.
Awesome.
I've enjoyed it. All right. So for mine, I'm gonna use editorial privilege because luckily I've got one written down, but we do many of these episodes, so I can just do this one later. I'm gonna build off of Zach's. It was a while ago. I read this book, When Genius Failed. It's about like the rise and fall of long-term capital. And I kind of had like a, you know, I didn't know a lot about this industry, even though I'm an economist and my parents think that I know a lot about this kind of stuff, but it was just this amazing sort of documentary almost. You know, I listened to it as an audio book about this, you know, when you can over leverage and how it happened. And there's like the human dimension about it. And it's these crazy smart people that were making money hand over fist. And then they got a little greedy. A little greedier. And it's just a great book that helped me kind of understand an industry that everyone thinks I understand.
Very cool. By the way, Zach is wearing a crypto shirt, so I don't know if we can believe it.
It says FTX, though. I don't know.
I'm actually issuing my own coin. If you all podcast subscribers could please buy it, that'd make me a lot of money. That'd be great.
Great. That's all that we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review. Thank you for our two guests and this fun panel, and hopefully it's useful. Thank you for tuning in. Bye.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you
so much for doing this.
Awesome.